Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to be talking with Professor Charles Gerber about how the U.S. has become a bullying nation and its consequences and how the deep state characters are behind all that. He's a professor of sociology at Boston College and a prolific expert in the area of sociology and the environment, social change. Then we're going to have some interesting audio clips. We're going to look at, oh, by the way, before I mention this, a lot of people are just not realizing that they should always have a backup number that in case they're out of, let's say, communication area or not near a computer or land-based radio. They can always call on any hardline or cell phone or computer the following number, and you can hear this program Monday to Friday, noon to 1, and Tuesday, 7 to 8 in the evening. Write it down, please, 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. And if you want to listen on the archives at any time, call 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. In fact, recently I was speaking with someone who had taken a train on a one-day trip instead of flying. He said the entire time he was downloading archive shows and kept him informed and entertained, and so you can do the same. So today we're going to have some audio clips on several issues, and I'm going to be going over these and showing you what happens when a person is lonely, especially men. And I don't think you realize that being lonely is a greater risk for a heart attack and early death than smoking or drinking. It's a big deal, and we're not dealing with it. And also, the current person who is likely to become the next CIA director, the votes are there. What you didn't know is that she was the chief of staff of the person responsible, Mr. Gonzalez, for at the CIA, of destroying all the interrogation tapes. And yet, the top people in the White House, the head of the CIA, Porter Groth, they all said don't. So how is it that if someone goes in direct violation of all their superiors who say keep the tapes and they go ahead and destroy them and nothing happens to that person or her? Now, if you're the chief of staff, you're able to communicate and do so on a daily basis and help a person with the policies they're making. And as you'll hear for her testimony that we haven't been made aware of, but today you will, she was aware of everything. She conveniently forgets what she doesn't want to be held accountable for. And this is the new person head of the CIA? Not good. So we have a lot to share, and we always begin, of course, with the latest on health and healing. There is a silent killer in our bodies. It's called homocysteine. And now, according to Temple University, it's been identified as metabolic risk factor for neurodegenerative diseases. Now, it's an amino acid, and it occurs naturally in the human body, and it's generated as a byproduct of methionine metabolism. And what happens is if we have a standard American diet, if we don't take proper supplementation, if we have too much red meat, and a deficiency of folic acid and B-complex, that's what leads to a high homocysteine level, or what is called hyperhomocysteinemia. Now, this condition causes considerable harm to your heart, and it can also now, according to this study, affect your brain. In a new study published on the journal Molecular Psychiatry, researchers at the Temple School of Medicine further revealed the extent to which elevated homocysteine damages the brain, and it's serious. Quote, accumulation of the amyloid plaque is responsible for the formation of neurofibrillary tangles in the brain of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. So in lay language, here's what we're talking about. If you have the standard American diet and you're not taking your supplements, you could have a very high homocysteine level, and that really puts you at risk of a heart attack or stroke. However, if you start switching more towards a plant-based diet and you take these four supplements, 25 milligrams of B6, 1 milligram of methylated folic acid, 1 milligram of methylated B12, and 200 milligrams of TMG, trimethylglycine, that will automatically lower down your homocysteine level. Something that easy, that inexpensive, you can do that on a daily basis. And here's the issue. A lot of people are not aware that they have an elevated homocysteine level. That's why it's a silent killer, just like high blood pressure. From the Cleveland Clinic comes an article about cholesterol, reducing it down could enhance T-cell cancer immunotherapy. Now, I've seen pros and I've seen cons. I've seen people undergo cancer immunotherapy, and it speeds up their death. I've seen that in several people, and they were told that it's a great new therapy, and it is not without its risks. And they do not have, in my opinion, quality science to justify heavy promotion of it. But in any case, the Cleveland Clinic researchers have demonstrated for the first time that lowering blood cholesterol levels could enhance the success of a specific type of T-cell immunotherapy in fighting cancer. So that's good, but I would say I would look at other holistic therapies before I would do that. From a university in Japan, rose hips melt body fat naturally. Now, you haven't heard about rose hip in probably 40 years. There was a time in the 1960s and 70s when if you were taking vitamin C, you took rose hip. But then one day I decided to do a little analysis. I wanted to see, to get 500 milligrams of rose hip, how much rose hip would I have to use in the bulk amount? How big would it be? It turned out to be the size of a golf ball. So pure rose hip was impractical. They probably today have different ways of doing it, so it's more realistic. But rose hip is just one of those wonderful sources of vitamin C. And rose hips are the fruit of the rose plant. They've been used medicinally for thousands of years. But new research shows it can be help you against obesity. And it can also help a lot of other conditions. And human research now suggests this fruit from the wild rose blossom may be an effective treatment for the modern epidemic of obesity. And earlier studies demonstrated that rose hip extract inhibits weight gain and decreases visceral fat, but it wasn't clear whether it could also help everyone, including humans. But the Japanese researchers decided to find out. They did a 12-week, double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized study, and with people who had a higher BMI, which is body mass index. In my opinion, ideal fat for men would be around 10 to 12%. Women, 12 to 15%. In a recent health support group we did, the average was 32%, some went as high as 47%. You really increase your risk of heart attacks and stroke when it's above 20. In any case, every day the subjects received a chewable tablet containing either a placebo or 100 milligrams of rose hip extract. And during the study, the participants didn't make any changes to their diets or their caloric intake. And then the researchers measured abdominal body fat, that's the subcutaneous and visceral fat, and body fat percentages and weight and body mass index at various times. After week 12, abdominal fat and visceral fat, what you see when you look at someone's body, a decrease significantly in the Rosep group and didn't decrease in the placebo group. So this is just another way that we could be helping people who are overweight, because Rosep powder, and you can get it in any health food store, is not expensive, and it's a strong anti-inflammatory. And the reason is that we're able to find a particular constituent in Rosep, which is a tyloroside, and that's a chemical naturally occurring in the Rosep powder that's a very strong antioxidant, antibacterial, and anti-inflammatory. So what I would do is I would take Rosehip by itself along with vitamin C and quercetin, those three things. From the Renmin Hospital of Wuhan in university, they looked at traditional Chinese medicine and they found that it's widely used for cardiovascular disease. And that's important. And there has been a lot of downplaying the significance of Ayurvedic medicine used in India and traditional Chinese medicine used in China and traditional Japanese medicine. And the skeptics, the people who consider themselves the world's expert on all this, they have no training or background in it, and they're, in my opinion, wrong on everything when it comes to health. They've had a lot of influence, especially on Wikipedia. I have my next report on Wikipedia for tomorrow, by the way. And I'm dealing specifically with traditional herbal medicine. And then I'm doing one on traditional Chinese medicine. But there are thousands upon tens of thousands of studies supporting this. So the authors provided a summary addressing the non-pharmacological approaches to helping people using traditional Chinese medicine, including acupuncture and moxibustion and qigong, tai chi. And they also discussed traditional anti-arrhythmic drugs related to this. So they're able to help people who have irregular heartbeat, who have bad hearts, who have cancer, using traditional Chinese medicine. And you're dealing with an awful lot of doctors and a huge number of patients and thousands of years of history. And, of course, in the last 50 years, a lot of modern science at more medical schools than what we have in the United States and larger laboratories doing as and even more sophisticated work than we are. So before you say, well, I read on Wikipedia that traditional Chinese medicine, it's not any good, don't believe it. It is, and is working. Also from Western University and Lawson Health Research Institute in Canada comes a new study about heart attacks and strokes can be predicted by our gut bacteria. They found a novel relationship between the microorganisms, your gut bacteria, and atherosclerosis, and they're linked, meaning good bacteria prevents heart attack and stroke. Bad bacteria precipitates. Now, there are over 400 different species of bacteria in your belly right now. And that can be the key to health or disease. Now, this was an article in the journal Atherosclerosis. The team of researchers from Canada report a link, direct link, between metabolites from your gut bacteria and the development of risky atherosclerotic plaques that are leading cause of heart attack and stroke. So we're suggesting that people have better bacteria. Now, many doctors in recent years have recommended a daily dose of about 100 milligrams of aspirin for anyone to prevent heart attack. But the very large European-based aspirin for asymptomatic atherosclerosis study, among others, suggested it was very irresponsible and very risky for doctors to make the claim. Why? Because aspirin is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. Anywhere from 25,000 to 40,000 people can die each year, and do, from just the bleeding that occurs when you take aspirin. It can thin the blood, but it also destroys the very four nutrients, or three of the four nutrients I mentioned earlier, including vitamin C. Vitamin C, B6, B12, folic acid, the four nutrients that help along with trimethylglycine, but are adversely affected when you take an aspirin. So as a result, here's the phenomena. And this is kind of the oxymoronic and virtually foolish way that medicine is practiced today. You're told to take an aspirin to thin your blood. But in the process of thinning the blood, you increase your homocysteine level. That increases your risk of a heart attack or a stroke. But the heart attack or stroke won't come because of, let's say, a clumping, because of, overly thick blood. And you're damaging your heart also, and your intestine, and you're disrupting that good bacteria in the gut. Now, if you want to thin the blood, green juices thin the blood. Terrific. Also, vitamin C thins the blood. And I suggest people take vitamin C about 6 to 8 times a day, because that way your body always has an antioxidant that's trapping free radicals, and therefore you're protecting your DNA all day long, including when you go to bed at night. So on the one hand, they're telling us good bacteria is good for the heart and prevents heart attacks and strokes. On the other hand, when you start taking antibiotics or other chemicals, you can disrupt that good bacteria, and that increases your risk of heart attack or stroke. Sounds a little confusing. By the way, the New York University has a study. It's about the cannabidiol, which is like the cannabinoids. It significantly reduces seizures in patients with severe forms of epilepsy. And the CBD, which is the canna, C-A-N-N-A, bidiol, B-I-D-I-O-L, that's a compound. It's derived from the cannabis plant that does not produce any high. And it's been an increasing focus of medical research. And it was shown in a new large-scale randomized controlled trial to significantly reduce the number of dangerous seizures in patients with a severe form of epilepsy called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So that's good. Just one more thing that it does among hundreds of other things. And I was once at one of my reunions back in my hometown. I think it was a 20-year reunion. And by that time, I started seeing an enormous difference in those who were living the standard American lifestyle versus those that were challenging it by doing things that were to their health. You could see the people with the premature gray hair and balding and the bellies and the fat and the jowliness, just the lack of vigor. And so we had a discussion, a bunch of us, and all these people had something in common. They were all in high school terrific athletes. I mean, just they had you could have bounced a quarter off any of their bellies. That's how much they were ripped. They had abs. They prided themselves because when you're in a small town, there's not a whole lot to do. You can go bowling. You can go shoot pool, which most of us did. And you can work out, which some of us did. And then the athletes for football or basketball, they work out generally in season, but there were some that kept in shape all the time. And many of those were my buddies. They were always in great shape. And none of them were in great shape 20 years later. They were all, you know, they gave it up. And their excuse was, well, Gary, you know, it's all in your genes. And so one said his father, his grandfather lived to be 95, and his grandmother lived to be 92. So he had the genes. And they were all using this excuse about genes. Well, in point of fact, it's not true. Let me explain this, and you can read this in a new article in the journal Menopause, the Journal of the North American Menopause Society. Exercise beats genetics in determining the amount of body fat and how long you're going to live. If you exercise, I'm suggesting, well, it depends. If you really want to be in phenomenal shape, 300 to 400 minutes a week. If you want to be in good shape and not be overweight, then 250 to 300 minutes a week. And that should also be a part of intense exercise. So let's just say that you were doing a 3-mile walk. Every half mile, speed it up as fast as you can for 100 yards, then slow it down. Those are intervals. All of the science right now shows that if no matter what your genetic predisposition is, you can exceed it. You can change it. You can alter it for the good. But it what works against you also. Let's just say that somewhere in your background you had someone who lived a long life, and you think, okay, well, they lived a long life. That means I'm going to live a long life. Well, did they smoke? And if so, how much? Did they drink? And if so, was it a hard liquor? And how often? How much? What was their diet like? Did they exercise? How did they deal with stress? Did they work in a clean or polluted environment? All of those are important. Did they have a quality relationship or not a quality relationship? That will all impact your genes, what is called the epigenetic factor. But let's just say you come from some poor genes and you start really kicking into high gear on exercising, having a clean, healthy diet, looking for quality relationships or a good one with yourself if you can't find another one, and getting out of poor environments, work environments, then you've exceeded the limitations of your genetic predisposition. I call this the laws of compensation. To the degree that you have any limitation, you must exceed that limitation. And when you do, in effect, you create a new quantum dynamic that collapses the previous dynamic under it. And hence, you see healing instead of diseasing. You see lengthening age instead of shortening it. So for all the people who thought, well, my genes are okay, they're not, and you can change them, but exercise does that, and it does it really well. We're 22 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break now. And when we come back from the break, we're going to play a couple short clips before we go to our guest. And we're going to play this one on loneliness. He does it kind of as a little satire, but behind his satire, there's a lot of reality to what he is saying. Please stay with us.
But I'm living with something that could send me to an early grave. Loneliness.
I never thought of myself as a lonely guy. I mean, I thought I had a lot of friends. It's like Neil. We hang out all the time.
I'd say I hang out with Dave approximately 2 times per year.
And I've got my work buddies, like Evan, and we always have really deep conversations.
What's up, dude?
What's up?
You heard the new Judas Priest album yet?
Yep.
It's pretty good.
It's all right.
Alright, well, good job, man.
The truth is, I'm like a lot of guys my age. We can be pretty lonely and not even realize it. Working, working out, even spending time with your significant other, all this stuff does a really good job of convincing you you're not socially isolated, even though you are. And they can also trick you into thinking you don't need to do the work of cultivating deep, personal connections with other people. But you do.
There are recent studies showing that loneliness increases your risk of mortality even more than smoking or obesity.
Some of the reasons are obvious. I mean, just think about it. Let's say you slip and fall and hit your head in your apartment. If no one's expecting you to call them, nobody will notice when you haven't called them. And then there's the fact that lonely people are less likely to have someone encourage them to eat right, or exercise, or to take their medicine. The former Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, said that loneliness puts your body in a constant state of stress. That increases inflammation, puts you at a greater risk of cardiovascular disease and other ailments. Murthy said that being lonely is just as hazardous to your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And just like kicking a pack-a-day smoking habit is really hard to do, loneliness can be a hard cycle to break, especially for men. One study found that only 11% of single men felt they had someone to turn to in a crisis. The thing is, men were taught to be tough, impenetrable even. But to make friends, you've got to be vulnerable and emotional. And that's the kind of stuff that we consider girly and gay. Our toxic masculinity is literally killing us. Take the same approach to keeping up with your friends that you do with working out or trying to eat right. Don't think of friendship as something extra, but as a really important part of having a healthy life. Call your college buddies. Talk about something deeper than who won the game last night. Ask that work buddy to grab a drink. Not just once or twice, but regularly. And take responsibility for your friendships. Don't just rely on your significant other to open up your social world. This stuff's not easy, I know that, but it's important. It could even save our lives. Share this video if you think men should take friendship seriously.
I do believe men and women should take friendship seriously. And I was just speaking last night with Eric, who is the son of Neil Kramer, my longtime buddy who just passed a year and a half ago. And interesting, because Neil didn't contact me, and I wanted to see why. Because I could have helped him. He'd still be alive today. But then again, all my friends who died would have been alive today had they taken my advice. We're up to 12 that have died. We're not talking about casual friendships. We're talking about long, long friendships, lifetime friendships. And I believe that in a lot of ways, each one of these people was lonely in their own way. And when you can get into a certain mindset of you don't want to show the weakest part of yourself. You don't want to be vulnerable even to your close friends, people that have accepted you for who you are, warts and all. And real friends accept each other. You make fun of your friends and make them laugh. They make fun of you and you laugh. Everybody laughs together because you know you're all human beings, you love each other, but you got to care enough that when you need something and you got a problem, share it. See if they have some suggestions, some input. And Eric said that, and Eric's a medical doctor, and he said that he felt that because he never took your advice ever when it came to health, that it was rather hypocritical now that he was suffering from this particular disease, that he should then reach out. And I said, that's just ridiculous. Well, yeah, it's ridiculous, but that's what people do. But what if you don't even have a friend? And today, a lot of people don't have any friends. They may have some acquaintances, but not real friends. So here's a question for you. What do you suggest so that people who have no real friends can start to bring friends into their lives? And I'll tell you, one of the largest groups that I'm finding, because I counsel them. In fact, at the recent retreat we did, I had repeated questions asked. Throughout the day, that I would do stop and do mini lectures. I did about 5 to 6 mini lectures a day, and then a long 3-hour lecture at night. It was about, I'll give you a good example. This is from one of the women. I'm 55 years of age, Gary, and my children, my family was my full-time occupation and focus for the last 25 years. But my husband and I got divorced after our kids were out of college, because we found we didn't have anything really in common anymore. Our family was what we had in common. Earlier, it was our responsibility to our careers and to our raising the kids and having a house. Everything was about making the money. And then one day, my husband asked me the following question. Does this make any sense? He says, I commute each day for an hour and a half each way, a commute I do not like, to get to a job that I do not like, to earn money so we can pay for a house that we're rarely at, except at night. What's wrong with this? And I had never thought of it that way. And he was right. We were just people sharing common space, but nothing that was intrinsic to our well-being. And she said, but now, like a lot of our friends, you can only have friends who are married friends. And then when you get divorced, those other couples frequently don't want anything to do with you. And so I'm starting off with zero friends at my age. I don't know where to begin. I don't trust these dating sites because I keep hearing horror stories from all my friends. Everybody lies about everything on there. I don't want to go through that. What do I do? So I did a whole lecture on this. What do you do? What suggestions would you give? Have you been in that same situation? How have you overcome it? I'd like to hear your response. 888-874-4888. What do you do with loneliness? Or if you're not lonely yourself, what do you do to suggest other people? Or what should they do that you would suggest? And before we go to our guest, I want to hear from you. Jack from Maryland. Jack, you're on the air. Your turn.
Oh, hey, Gary. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
A lot of people don't know how to make friends or anything like that. For instance, I got a buddy who was born the very same day I was, and he's an introvert, but I'm the extrovert. And I moved to a small town, didn't know anyone. Within 2 weeks, I knew 50, 60 people. Well, maybe not that many, but I had a routine, and I could, make new friends very easily where my buddy can't. And he has very few friends and treasures them. I have a lot of friends and treasure them, but some of them are so-called friends, but you don't know until you get into a crisis. So to avoid, being friendless, most guys, they stick to their high school buddies and can't go beyond that. But I can go in a new city and meet people within 2 weeks, have a routine.
You've made a couple important points, Jack. Let's focus for a second on them. One is that you call yourself an extrovert. I don't believe that we have extroverts and introverts per se. I did some work on what we call life energies. This happened over 20 years ago when I had an epiphany, and I suddenly saw there were 7 archetypes of individuals, the adaptive supportives. These are the worker bees of society. These are the people who are going to go to work every day for 40 years, and they're going to be very comfortable and very happy with very little. But family is always important to them. Continuity is important. Having certain values is important. They're not looking to get rich, but they can live within their means. And if any group ever lives within their means, historically it has been the adaptive supportives. And these are the people that go to work in a shovel factory or farming or go sew a dress. Whatever they're doing, they're going to be very competent. They will master it. And they have a small number of friends. It's not easy for them to make friends. And generally, the friends come, as you suggested in your other point, from high school, because these are people they know and hence they can trust. The biggest issue with men in gaining new friendship is, can they trust someone? Because they like to believe in someone. You go into a relationship with a sense of openness, that whatever someone's telling you, you're going to believe, and you want that trust to go both ways. You want them to trust you, so you honor your word, things like character and the ethics of a friendship. You're not there to exploit the friendship. It's not easy for that group to just go out and make a new friend. You might call that group more introverted than extroverted, but then you take a dynamic supportive. They walk into a room, they light the room up. Suddenly the energy's on them. Not that they're brighter or more gifted, it's just their energy's different. They attract people. People want to be with them because their energy is a very up energy. And that would probably be what your life energy is. And hence, no matter where you went, if you were in the middle of the Sahara Desert, you would end up making a friend out of a pineapple. You're going to have friendships no matter where you go in life. And good for you, because generally dynamic supportives, they're dynamic because they're charismatic. They tend to see the big picture of life. They have that sense of knowing where they don't have to have a reductionist explanation for everything. And those individuals also tend to be very comfortable to be around. The more comfortable you are to be around, the more likely it is that people will enjoy being in your company. You're not going to be hypercritical of them. You're not going to be condemning people. You're not going to be judging them. You're not going to make them feel insecure or inferior. You're not going to be constantly competing with them to show that, you know, you're the alpha male. Dynamic supportives don't do that. They're very good at bringing out the best in another person and encouraging that person. In effect, they make great life coaches. They make great. One of the most important people in my life was a Coach Kincaid back in seventh grade. He was terrific, and he taught me the rule of whatever you're going to do in life, relax into it. A simple story. In scrimmage, I would always do extremely well because I loved playing basketball. But in a game, my first two games, I didn't do well at all. Everything you could do wrong, I did wrong. And then after the game, he said, "What are you thinking when you're getting the ball?" And I told him, "Well, I'm thinking about who's going to be open. Can I get open? Can I get the shot?" And he said, "No, that's not important. What's important is to have fun with it. Because every time I see you in scrimmage, in practice, you're having fun. So the next game, go out there and have fun. Like it's one big scrimmage. Just relax into it." And I thought about that. And indeed, I did that, and suddenly it changed completely. To this day, every single competitive thing I do relaxing into it, so it's not stressful. And therefore, there's a greater capacity when you're not stressed. Remember, when you're stressed, everything constricts. When you're relaxed, everything expands. Hence, expand in relaxing into being. So dynamic supportives are wonderful for all of us. I thank you, Jack, for calling in from Maryland and sharing your insights. Very instructive. Appreciate it. We'll take one more before we go to our guest, Sophia from New York. Sophie, your turn. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Gary. I believe that friendships are very important, and not everyone is friendly and have an open smile. But I believe that hobbies, if you can have hobbies in your life, like dancing, like learning an instrument, perhaps foster a pet, that helps so much in your life. There are dance lessons in New York, and I'm sure in many cities that people can take free dance lessons. Many studios offer these lessons, and it's not a meat market. It really is that people meet each other and they have common interests, common skill. And I've been to dance studios that there are 70-year-old people, men or women, dancing with the 20-year-olds. And because they have a common interest, they want to dance, and dancing makes everyone happy. Also, listening to classical music, listening to music that makes you happy. Gardening, walking, find a partner that likes walking so you can walk together. Perhaps advertise on Craigslist and request that I'm looking for a walking partner. All these things could create friendships.
Very practical advice, and you're spot on with that. I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Sophie, for calling in and sharing your thoughts. I want to thank you for calling in, and now we're going up to Newton, Massachusetts. We're standing by as Professor Charles Derber, D-E-R-B-E-R. As I mentioned earlier, he's professor of sociology at Boston College and a prolific author specializing in political economy, sociology, and the environment, and environmental social changes. And he's written on economic crisis, capitalism, and globalization, and corporate culture, fascism, and war and peace, and progressive movements. And he is also an author of several important books, including Sociopathic Society, The Morality Wars, and his latest is Bully Nation, How the American Establishment Creates a Bullying Society, co-written with University of Massachusetts sociology professor Yale Magris. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Gary.
Reviewing your writing and noting that many areas of our economic and political and social culture where bullying has become the norm. I realize we can take this conversation in many different directions, and we can ask the question whether the election of Donald Trump is a product, in part, of the institutionalization of bullying throughout our culture. Trump's campaign was run primarily on a strategy of bullying and demeaning and denigrating his opponents. And there was no substance whatsoever, in my opinion, no thought-out proposals or evidence he had a sound knowledge about anything that concerns domestic or international governance, nor the role and function of a president. Even our neoliberal capitalist market system, by a bullying agenda, such as forcing poor nations into structural debt, that's what the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank does, and imposing conditions of undertaking austerity measures, look at Greece, where they're dumpster diving, and people who had retired after a noble career now have to go back to work because they can't afford it. And these are simply measures where bank loans and interest on those bank loans and payday loans in the United States become a form, in my opinion, of bullying. And do you believe that this is bullying through economic colonization by the corporate and banking elites? And we should note that the rest of the world increasingly regards the United States as a single biggest bully in the community of nations, and our government bullies every international body it is a member of, whether it is the UN, the International Climate Organizations, the International Criminal Courts, the World Economic Forum, NATO, the World Trade Organization, and so on. So the question then is, why do most Americans feel this is perfectly normal and okay, and it's not discussed? And what does it say about how deeply ingrained bullying has become in our society? The forum is yours.
Well, that's a very helpful introduction to the whole theme of this book, which is called Bully Nation, Gary. And we wrote it before Trump was elected, just before, but Trump has simply magnified the awareness that's growing that there's something deeply wrong. It was interesting listening to your prior discussion about stress and relaxation and being happy. And of course, bullying evokes all the other opposite reactions of anger and demeaning people and bigotry and violence and so forth. So it's a more painful subject to talk about. I think one thing, just before I get to your main point, that I want to sort of say is at the heart of the book's idea is that it's an effort to reconceive the whole vocabulary we have and sort of mindset we have for thinking about the very idea of what bullying is. It's basically an idea that's been appropriated by psychologists and psychiatrists as a kind of sort of like as an analog to gun violence, as the problem is really mental health. And so people, I think, when they think of bullies, even Donald Trump, they often think, well, this is a kind of mental, a psychological disturbance, which reflects the larger kind of reduction of conversation about big issues in the United States to personal psychology rather than to the institutional realities and the economic and political and social forces you were beginning to talk about that are very central to shaping how we operate as individuals. And so the sort of headline of the book is that most people have learned to think about bullying as something that kids do in schools, maybe online now in cyberbullying, but they don't think of bullying as something that's characteristic of adults or of institutions, you know, not just people, but of things like the kind of big banks you were talking about or the corporations or the U.S. military and so forth. So the basic, you know, the sort of overview of the book is to say we really have a kind of very distorted framework for thinking about bullying by kind of tending to limit it to something that children have and might grow out of, and which is sort of a developmental issue in people's psychology as against some sort of larger cultural, political, economic problem that's embedded deep in our, you know, economic and kind of capitalism and militarism and so forth. So that's sort of the overview for thinking about these other questions we're likely to get into. And it reflects, I think, also a cultural problem generally, that the way social systems maintain themselves is to look at any problem and sort of say, well, they're really reflection of kind of bad apples in the people. You know, they're people who have gone a little bit off, and they don't reflect any problem in the larger society. And the purpose of therapy then becomes to adapt people to the larger society. But what if the larger society is something like a bullying culture and a bullying society, which actually helps shape people into bullies and is run by institutions that are by their nature, creating large scale forms of very, very damaging bullying. And so that's why I think we need to make this kind of leap from a psychological interpretation of bullying into a more institutional bullying. So, yes, so the argument, let me just add one other thing. Whether you think of bullying purely in a personal way or, you know, and on schoolyards or in a big macro economic and political way about, or a military way about the world, it's always about a problem of power and inequalities of power. Almost all traditional definitions and the definitions that we talk about are that you become vulnerable to bullying whenever there are inequalities of power. And this has come out in the Me Too movement, and you know that this is a reflection of, you know, that the abuse and the kind of bullying that the Me Too movement has identified, and it seemed to be so widespread now, is a reflection really of a problem of power, and power in differences in the workplace, differences of male-dominated cultures, and so forth. And this is generally true of power, that if you live in a society which is marked by very, very extreme inequalities or differences of power, they're almost always going to lead to high levels of bullying. So in some sense, you can simply think about bullying as a manifestation of inequalities of power, where that power then is easily and tends to get abused. So Donald Trump is modeling bullying, obviously. I mean, almost everybody, whether they support him or not, I think tends to see him as a personal bully. And he does, in a very naked way, embody, in my judgment, the something that is not as well understood in our culture, which is that he is admired partly because he is a bully. And he's kind of overt about it. He kind of is, rather than, as tends to be the case in the United States, you know, we have a strong anti-bullying kind of culture now, which we're in schools, they tend to try to discourage bullying and so forth. But it's very hard to do in a society where bullying is sort of built into the fabric of institutions. And so I think it's a mistake to say, I mean, certainly Trump is perpetuating and sort of normalizing an extreme and kind of naked level of bullying. But I think his popularity reflects the fact that deep in our society are these forces that kind of incentivize or encourage all of us to either carry out bullying or to accept it as sort of part of normal life and part of something that's necessary to be successful and to get things done and to sort of win whatever your version of the American dream is. So yes, I think that the central thing to take away here is that Trump's bullying is a reflection of something deeper in our culture. And even when Trump goes away, whether it's sooner or later, we are going to be faced with all of the kind of power abuses that translate into bullying and that are embedded in our economic system and in our way of, as a country, of relating to the world, which involves a tremendous amount of military bullying and so forth. So this is something that's enduring in our culture. It's built into the fabric of our society. And if you'd like, I can go into more of why I think that both capitalist economies and highly militarized societies tend to be, sort of addicted to a model of bullying as a way of both institutional and individual behavior.
I want to bring in a little different perspective for you to offer your insight in.
Okay.
I believe that you're absolutely correct that the institutionalization of bullying has been happening without us being fully aware of it. For example, if you're an African American or a person of color and you're walking down the street, especially in New York City or in Los Angeles, some other communities, there's a high probability at some point, depending upon how you're dressed, that you could be pulled over and just for stop and search. That's bullying. When you're driving now in almost half of southern states and western states, you can be pulled over for no infraction for asset seizure, $4 billion last year. That's bullying. When you are told that that you are of no value in New York City if you're a tenant, I can tell you this from personal experience, and if you don't pay an escalating rent, they'll just put someone else in your place. That's a form of the corporatization of the landlord class bullying anyone that you want to be here, you pay me. I don't care about you, your business, your customers. All I care about is I want my money. And then you look at the silk voice and the soft glove inside of which is an absolutely tyrannical hand, Barack Obama. Smooth as silk, great orator, never finished a sentence without some form of platitude. And yet, seven nations he went to war with, he won a Nobel Prize for Peace, at the same time had a Tuesday morning kill list that was prepared, and no one seemed to mind that. And the National Defense Authorization Act, where we reduced all of our rights to he can have you arrested, shot. And yet, because he did it all with a nice smile, we didn't pay attention. Same way with Bill Clinton. Very charismatic, very charming. And yet, look what he did to the 500,000 children in Bosnia, or excuse me, in Iraq, who died because of sanctions that he and his wife were firm about and Madeleine Albright supported. She was not smooth and soft and charismatic. He was. His wife is not. And so I think we tend to either accept or reject more or less the bullying, depending upon how it manifests. If you have a cop walking the beat, like in West Side Story, and wants to know what's going on, it's different than you suddenly see a guy dressed up like he's in combat, and he's in your neighborhood, and there's 80,000 SWAT teams. That's militarization of the police, and that's bullying. And then when you start realizing the National Defense Authorization Act allows anyone in any federal agency to do whatever they want with any of us, and you can't go through an airport unless you're given an inspection at their will. So everywhere I'm looking, I'm seeing payday loans that are charging upwards of 1,000% interest if they keep rolling it over, and there's no way you're going to pay it. That's bullying. I see return to debtors' prisons that were outlawed in 1833. That's bullying. I see the incarceration of people by class and ethnicity for the same crime that a Caucasian upper-middle-class person would not go to jail. They are going to jail. That's bullying. I see that we have no reality of what goes on in prison. We don't care. And as a result, when you go to prison, not only are you suffering being isolated from your family and the rest of society because of what is perceived as your crime, but now you're going to be bullied in a bullying situation, including rape. The armed forces, we intentionally over-masculize both men and women so that they don't have a problem questioning whether or not their bullying will be appropriate or not. So I'm looking at it from a large point of view, and I'm seeing bullying at every single level of our society. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that's brilliantly put. I mean, I think you've given a panorama there of, that sort of, and, this is beginning to lead to these kinds of resistance movements that you see with Black Lives Matter. I mean, the feeling that blacks feel when they walk down the street, they're constantly afraid because they can be pulled over at any time and are likely to be subject to certain kinds of bullying or violence and so forth. I also like the fact that I think Obama is personally not disposed so much, doesn't sort of embody that kind of bullying temperament that Trump obviously does. But you're so correct to show that he really, Obama, despite his probably relatively unbullying kind of personality, moved into a bullying kind of foreign policy and to some degree domestic policy, which didn't reflect his psychology, but just it was a reflection of how much when you think about bullying, you have to think about systemic forces. You know, what are the underlying foreign policy drives that lead Obama to, you know, open up so much expanded, you know, drone warfare and to, you know, open up many, many more what are called lily pad bases in Africa and so forth, to deport more people than ever before. You realize that whatever your own personality is, that you're dealing with institutions and political structures and economic structures that are going to drive almost anybody into bullying behavior. So let me just take one something that every viewer who's a working age person can relate to, whether whatever race or gender you are, which is if you're working in a corporation or in almost any, you know, workplace in our society, if there's sort of embedded a bullying dynamic that makes work, which is, you know, most of us have to work in order to survive, makes you subject to bullying because the reality is in any kind of capitalist society is that you're basically subject to a power hierarchy. And if you don't conform to the demands, if you basically don't obey people above you, who really have the authority to pretty much tell you what you should do, whether it's, you know, what you're doing online at work or how you're dressed and or what your hair looks like or whatever, you're kind of, because jobs for a very large, you know, in a basically highly and, you know, economically insecure population, you have to be afraid most of your work life that you're vulnerable to being thrown out. And if you don't do exactly what you think people who have some power over you in the management want. And so almost everybody working, almost at any faith, but certainly at the vast majority of people, we know that one of the recent studies on inequality showed that about 150 million Americans are just about a couple of weeks away. You know, if they lost their paycheck for a couple of weeks, would be thrown into poverty and they would not be able to pay for medical bills or pay for rent and so forth. So a huge number of people in the society in their daily lives, as you say, it's not talked about as bullying. So people don't necessarily feel that what they're experiencing is actually bullying, but it actually is simply very much the essence of bullying, which is that you're feeling subject to kind of arbitrary power, humiliation, authority. You have to do whether it's reasonable or not, what people above you are telling, because you're afraid that you can, in fact, be thrown out. And as you move toward a kind of labor market, I mean, let me just use one more example from the university. You know, when I came into the university, most professors had on a tenure track model where they.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll invite you back for a more extended interview. Thank you very much, Professor Charles Gerber. And again, his latest book is about Bully Nation. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.